Okay, so what I want to do today is discuss forgiveness, and I want to do it from two perspectives, because I think a lot of clinical people either didn't get a lot of training in this, and a lot of pastoral people don't understand that there's a lot of clinical elements to this. So I think pastoral people and clinical people can come together on this topic and kind of learn from each other. So what I'm going to do is try to use some resources from clinical psychology as well as from pastoral counseling and addiction recovery things to kind of show how this fits together, that we're really talking about forgiveness as a psycho-spiritual issue, not just one or the other. To begin with, I want to comment on what I've been reading over the past 10, 15 years about the issue of victimhood and trauma. And one of the things that I've seen is that from the clinical perspective and even on the pastoral area a lot, we see that the goals of therapy seem to be focused around confrontation of the perpetrator and getting justice and punishing. And they are the two primary focuses of therapy in this area. I think what we need to be able to do is add another layer to that, which would be the issue of forgiveness. And I think that is very often misconstrued as making believe it didn't happen or justifying not reacting to it. And it's kind of tied up with the issue that we want to bring closure. And I think with any kind of trauma, closure really has to be understood not as denying the experience, but rather integrating it into a person's life and belief system. So, you know, we've seen from the clinical perspective over years that we move from a Freudian concept, which did not include much spirituality at all, if any. There's probably a few little issues where Freud did comment on spirituality, but he had a really difficult time separating spirituality from religion. And there was a strong denial of religious activity in therapy, but he did make some comments that kind of opened the door to spirituality without religion. I don't think it was something he was very consciously doing, but subconsciously. And that was a pun. Freud did work with the subconscious. Anyway, that's a joke that went over everyone's head, and I apologize. The next level that we kind of grew into was Jungian thought, where we now did include a lot of spiritual thinking. In the addiction field, one of the things that we frequently forget is that Jung had a lot to do with communicating with Bill Wilson about early recovery issues and the need to address the spirituality. So Jung, who's one of my favorites, actually, because he was integrating both of these, that he was opening the door in clinical realms to the possibility of the spirituality of the human person being able to be integrated into the person's psyche. We then saw, and it was right around the same time that Jung was doing a lot of his work, that we started to see a new professional group of pastoral counselors coming in. And pastoral counselors were what I would describe as the first of the mental health professions that integrated a way of normalizing spirituality and therapy. This was the first of the holistic approaches to counseling. This was basically a professional rediscovery of spirituality. And the attempt to integrate the theory of psycho-spiritual counseling. One of the first people that I like to look at is Dana Dayton, Tina Dayton, PhD. Her primary book is a book called The Magic of Forgiveness. And she identifies five steps to forgiveness. The first step is waking up, being aware of it. Secondly, identifying the anger and the resentment to whatever the trauma experience was. Accepting and recognizing the hurt and the sadness. Number four was acceptance, integration, and letting go. And then the fifth step was reorganizing and reinvestment in life. So that she was able to identify a standardized process for finding forgiveness. The next resource is a married couple, both of them psychologists. I find it difficult to comprehend that two psychologists could live in the same house in a relationship without killing each other. But Janice Spring and Michael Spring, they wrote a book, How Can I Forgive You? The Courage to Forgive and the Freedom Not to. I've actually used this book a lot with couples who are dealing with unfaithfulness in their relationship. And what I do with this book, and I always buy this book in pairs, is I give each of them a book. I tell them to read one chapter at a time a week, and then we discuss the contents of that chapter in the next session. And I tell them, do not discuss it among yourselves. Just reflect on it yourself, make some notes, and then when we come together, we'll discuss the integration of both of your perceptions. And I do this with full knowledge that they're not going to do what I said, that they will discuss it on their own. And that means that by the time I get to them, I'm working with two people that have already started a reflection on this. So I find that it becomes a much quicker way to get through the process. Well, they discuss 10 steps to forgiveness. The first is to honor the full sweep of their emotions about the traumatic experience. Give up your need for revenge, but continue to seek a just resolution. That's step two. Step three is stop obsessing about the injury and re-engage with life. Four is protect yourself from future harm or abuse. Five, frame the offender's behavior in terms of their own personal struggles. That's an interesting way to start formulating this approach, because they have to put themselves in someone else's shoes. Now, because of their integrated relationship, because this is usually about couples, they have a difficult time separating themselves from the other. So making them integrate this is an important thing. They have to look honestly at their own contribution to the injury. And when I'm working with couples, I make sure that they don't interpret this, that they are the cause for the breakdown in the relationship. I make sure that they understand that the relationship is the two of them, and they have integrated responsibility here. Challenge the false assumptions about what happened, because each of them will have a different perception. Look at the offender apart from the offense, weighing the good against the bad. Carefully decide the kind of relationship, if any, they choose to have with the offender, and forgive yourself your failings. And I think that's a much longer process, but I think it's a lot more complete. But that their approach is primarily aimed at folks that are having unfaithfulness within their relationship. So the issue of dealing with affairs. The next one I want to look at is Henry Nouwen. He's coming from a more pastoral approach. He died recently, a PhD in psychology, and he taught at Yale. And he also has a doctorate in theology. He's Dutch by nationality, spent most of his last years teaching in the U.S., and specifically at Yale Divinity. And he did it in terms of two primary books. He wrote many, many books, but two that were important in understanding his approach to forgiveness. One was called The Return of the Prodigal Son, and the other is The Wounded Healer. And these are two books that give a rather good in-depth approach to an understanding of how pastoral theology and pastoral psychology can be integrated into mainstream clinical psychology. And he gives four steps to forgiveness. The first is to reflect and admit to oneself what the wrong was. Two, you have to verbalize it to another, and this is where the therapeutics start coming in. Next, there has to be some kind of absolution given, and then some kind of penance. Okay, so this is obviously coming from a somewhat Catholic background, but I'll show how we can integrate that into the clinical realm as well. The next step is coming from 12-step programs. The primary book to read for this one is a relatively short book. It's called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And there they have four steps to finding forgiveness. One is make a searching and fearless moral inventory for yourself. Two, make a list of all those that you have harmed. Review and share this list with another person. Make amends when appropriate. And in with this approach, while it's mostly around issues of chemical dependencies, with AA and NA and CA as the primary ones, I find that it's also important to understand this in terms of the behavioral addictions. I've seen this with compulsive gambling and gambling addiction, and also more recently, and I just got a little binge of new clients with sexual addictions. Apparently, spending 18 months at home gets people involved in things that they didn't think was such a problem. And the sexual addiction thing, I think, is starting to surface a lot more, at least in the counties around the area where I work. So that's an important one. So what we want to do is start looking at a blended model for clinical professionals. Okay. And I'm basing this on seven pillars of knowledge and experience that I've had myself. One involves a lot of clinical reading, a lot of pastoral reading, my clinical experience and pastoral experience. And while I have a clinical license, I still also do some totally pastoral counseling. I try to separate that, and I keep my pastoral counseling under the roof of the church, whereas my clinical work is done in an office. I try to keep those two approaches very separate. 12-step experience, not just with the basic AANA type thing, but with a number of self-help groups. If you're not familiar with the number of self-help groups available based on 12-step work with a variety of issues, not just the various chemical addictions, but also the behavioral addictions. And there's a lot of thinking in seminary work these days that this is something that has been overlooked in pastoral training. especially in Catholic seminary training, where I've got most of my experience, they spend a lot of time talking about different approaches to spirituality. And they talk about Franciscan spirituality and Jesuit spirituality and Dominican spirituality and all this kind of stuff. The one thing that they do not talk about, which includes the largest number of Christians and Catholics associating with a spiritual tradition, is 12-step spirituality. If we took a survey of most Catholics, we would find the higher percentage who follow a 12-step spirituality, and this is very much in keeping with Catholic tradition. So the number one approach to spirituality among the lay folk and also clergy is really 12-step spirituality, and we don't even bring it up in our teaching programs at seminary. So I spend a lot of time trying to talk about this with people in pastoral areas. I have a lot of teaching and preaching experience. And I think an important part of blending these models is the ability to reflect and meditate on the issue of forgiveness, okay, and how this all comes to play. So for this integrated paradigm of forgiveness in a clinical setting, we need to remember that it may involve a deity. Now, my pastoral counseling doctorate, I had an interesting problem, because when I brought up that I wanted to do my thesis, my project on understanding and assessing spiritual health in the treatment of addictions, in my original proposal, I said that I wanted to do this for theists as well as non-theists. And the director of my committee was a Jesuit, former Jesuit, who indicated that you can't get a degree in pastoral counseling when you're talking about atheists. And I said, well, I believe you can. And I had a rather robust, like 6-month discussion with the committee members, because I think that atheism is a religion, agnosticism is a religion, and they do have spiritual belief systems associated with them. So I finally got the okay to proceed. So I developed my project around an understanding of spirituality for both theists and non-theists. But spirituality is not only for those that believe in a deity. You can have a spirituality based entirely on a humanistic approach. And I think that that's where those two sides come together. The theists and the non-theists can come together with understanding spiritual issues and spirituality. It has to be based always on the client's belief system. You cannot force your belief system on the client. I think this is something that clinicians are commonly aware of. You can't have a judgment on any religious or spiritual tradition. Now, I think this is an interesting issue, because sometimes our own spiritual convictions seep into our therapy. And sometimes from a believer's or a theist's point of view, we're trying to basically get them out of that non-theist approach. For those that are non-theists, I think there's a real tendency to try to convince the person that their religious belief system is either wrong or shouldn't be considered as part of the therapy. And I think we need to be able to get to the point where we recognize that it really doesn't matter what we think, it's what the client's belief system is, and respecting that. We need to be able to help spiritual professionals to better understand the process that they've been using longer than anybody else. Okay. Spiritual traditions from thousands of years before the birth of Jesus, thousands of years various religious traditions have always identified forgiveness as an important part of spirituality. And it doesn't matter whether it's Eastern or Western spiritualities. It doesn't matter whether it's a strong theistic approach or a very philosophical approach. The issue of forgiveness has always come up as one of the main issues. So let's look at this integrated model. Step one, there has to be an acceptance of reality. We have to move from denial to dealing. We have to recognize that the pain, the hurt, the trauma is a real thing. We have to challenge the false assumptions about the cause of the pain or the hurt. We have to reflect on the meaning from viewpoints of both the offender and the victim. Now, this is going to take a lot of work, and it's best done with talking therapy. Now, there can be some decent homework assignments with reading material, but you really have to get into the issue of what is the meaning of the hurt from the point of view of the perpetrator and the victim. And the victim has to start to understand the meaning from the perpetrator's perspective, and the perpetrator has to understand the meaning from the victim's point. And they have to understand the impact on comprehensive health. That if a person is not able to deal with this issue of forgiveness, there will be physiological, emotional side effects. And this will lead to all kinds of issues of depression, anxiety, and that's the minimum. And that will be there. We also have to understand the effect on physical health, the way people's blood pressure is affected, the way people's physiological stress is enhanced every time they get caught up in this cycle, which will frequently involve a lot of post-traumatic stress. That unless they're able to deal with this, this will continue, and not only continue, but the post-traumatic stress will get worse and worse and worse if they don't deal with it. So that's an important thing that we have to understand about this. Step two is to accept, honor, and process feelings. And the two main are pain and hurt. There's a lot of anger that develops towards self and others. There's a lot of depression and sadness. The issue of resentments is an important thing. And in the addiction field, in the 12-step approaches, resentments is an issue that is specifically identified as an issue to be addressed. The thing that is cultural, very cultural in the U.S., is they have to recognize the feeling of the need for revenge. In American culture, whenever there's a perpetration of any kind of pain, the main tendency in American culture is to look for revenge. And we have to be able to identify this. The next thing is we have to respect and honor the issue of shame. And I think people do not really comprehend the levels that take place in shame. Now, from my pastoral experience, as a Catholic priest, I hear confessions. And sometimes people will come in and try to confess shame. And I don't try to mess up people's minds. I think that's not my job. But I frequently say, I cannot forgive the sin of shame. Because shame is not a violation of your relationship with God. Shame is something within you that you have to process and you have to be the one to resolve. So I'll suggest that they find a counselor someplace or a spiritual director who's going to help them work through that. But shame is a very real feeling. It's a very real emotional state, but we have to understand where this fits into the total process. Step three is verbalizing this to another person. All of this. And this is where counselors and pastoral people can both do the same thing in two different systems. It needs to be done with the one who is violated. Now, there are times when the person that was violated and the violator are not going to come together in the same room. Okay. But it has to be verbalized to another person. The therapist can be one. The pastoral professional can be another. But it needs to be interpersonal. And in this age of Zooming, I think Zooming is not the best way to do it. And even though there's a lot of therapy going on online and that sort of thing, those of you who know me know that I really don't like the idea, because I think Zooming and that kind of relationship is interactive, but it's really not interpersonal. I think it's very difficult to have an interpersonal relationship with a screen. I think the ability to be face-to-face with someone allows for that connection, and I think that's something that we have to be able to look at. It can be done in a community, and sometimes a closed recovery group can do this. Sometimes a religious group can do this. I know there are some groups, some religious groups, that when they meet, part of what they do is discuss their sinfulness. They discuss the ways that they need to change their behaviors to open up to a more wholesome and healthy approach to living. And sometimes it can be done with the deity. Now, you have to be kind of careful how you do this in a clinical setting, but if a person has a belief system where the deity is part of the forgiveness process, then calling in the deity for the counselee can be a very legitimate approach. This approach works very easily when a person is involved in 12-step spirituality. So who do you share with? The true verbalization is a concrete acceptance, expression of who we are. It's our internal self. And we must allow for confrontation, a deeper questioning, and an explanation of motivation or thinking. And the reason is because we don't want to fool ourselves about the reality of the situation. This goes back to the first step here. There's an acceptance of reality, and there's a tendency on the part of a lot of people to make believe that reality is not, it's so personalized that we can miss the relationships outside of us. So that's why I think the need for a personal interaction is so important. And, you know, if need be, you can work on it distance, I suppose. But I think it works best when it's a face-to-face situation. Step four is letting go. And part of the letting go is reframing the entire experience of the offense. Usually when a person is holding on to the trauma, they're sticking in the past with themselves, and they need to be able to reframe it and look at the larger picture. So they need to look honestly at their own contribution to the offense, if any. They have to stop obsessing about it, and they have to see the offense apart from the offender. Okay. Now, an analogy, and this comes from Naunin, he uses the example of a hurt, of identifying it as a cut or a gash. If we get a major cut in part of our body, that kind of erupts and we see the flesh underneath the skin, the blood is coming out, we tend to associate a cut as pain and as a negative experience. And he suggests that if you ever get the opportunity to go to the Grand Canyon and you spend a couple of hours just sitting on the edge viewing the canyon, you will see that as the sun goes by, the colors change, the view of the canyon changes, and it becomes an awesome experience of change. And he suggests that looking at a wound in ourselves, something like the Grand Canyon, we can see that the wound, while it may be painful, can also be a way that we understand the fullness of what the experience was. And that it's not necessarily all negative. That we can see things and learn things about ourselves that we could never do if we didn't have the pain. Now, that's not to say that being a victim is a good thing. It's not giving the victimizer a free pass, but it's just recognizing that who I am includes the cuts and the gashes in my body. Another analogy of letting go and holding in, and I really forget where I got this. I picked it up at a lecture someplace where this kind of trauma, this pain, it was given by a physician that was an internist. And he suggested that we look at these kinds of issues of pain as an anthropological, gastrointestinal, psycho-spiritual, physiological disorder. That these kind of pains just erupt and affect every part of our system. And we need to be able to experience that before we can begin to let it go. And while we're looking at releasing resentments, we're looking at the need, releasing the need for revenge, and looking at the emotional investments that we have in the offense. That while we're doing all of that, we can always continue to work towards justice if the offender needs justice. Okay. But if it's obsessional, it can prevent the releasing or the letting go, and it will prevent forgiveness. If the obsession for revenge continues, we will always be held in the back, in the past, and we will never be able to move on. We have to recognize that there is a need for re-engaging with life. Moving on motivates us to reorganize our thinking and feelings about the offense. And the refusal to be hung, get hung up or shackled to the past. And that prevents us from moving on to the future. And moving on to the future is essential for developing hope. So the choices have to be made. Do I forgive or do I not forgive? If I forgive, what kind of relationship will I have with the offender, if any? I can forgive and still choose not to have a relationship with the offender, but I'm still forgiving the past. I can forgive the past, I can forgive the offender, even if the offender is not directly involved in the process. Okay. So we need to be able to continue these steps. Step five is the action of forgiving and being forgiven. The initiation is sometimes begun or initiated by the offender and sometimes by the victim. The offender may initiate it, but the victim will have to be able to be part of the comprehensive process. the offender may or may not be choosing to be part of the involvement. Now, there's a difference between forgiving and absolution. Okay. Absolution is a comprehensive process of forgiving and being forgiven. Now, in some cases, this absolution phase is not going to be achieved. These are the stages where the two parties come together and recognize their own involvement, and they recognize their own healing through the pain, through the trauma. If only one party is involved in it, you can still get to forgiveness, but you may not get the comprehensive process. The individual has a reinvestment in life. The future is more important than the past. The process of integrating the offense into their personal identity is going to be an important part of the process. And the once negative experience is now seen as a building block for one's life. There's the parable of the potter and the clay. This comes out of Old Testament spirituality. And the way I try to use this is to ask people to view. And you can find these things online. You can find some pictures of people working with clay sculptures. And I ask that people reflect on the clay sculpture process as a way of understanding how to integrate their own pain into the healing process. I've seen potters working. And if you've never seen one, it's worth going out of your way to find one. Because they start off with a glob of clay, which just looks like a pile of clay, or depending on your relationship with the client, you can explain that it looks like a pile of shit. Okay. It's not a pretty thing. It's got no real form or purpose, but it's just this thing. And then the potter gets involved. And if you watch the potter working with their hands, they will take the clay and they will, if they're making a cup or a pot or a bowl, they will start off by taking their fist and once it's spinning and punching it into the clay. Now, normally punching like that is considered a violent act, but they punch the clay and then they punch the sides. They manipulate it. And eventually, after a while, they come up with a piece of art that is a beautiful piece of sculpture. And if we try to understand our pains and our hurts from the point of view of the potter is not trying to hurt the clay. The potter is trying to form it into something more perfect. And that's a way that people can start to learn to integrate the pain that they experience in life and try to understand how to integrate that into who they are and who they are becoming. The past has to be kept in the past. The experience of the present is important to affect because you can't move on to the future unless you first embrace the present. And the present is sometimes still painful. The present is sometimes still confusing. The present is sometimes still creating pain. But unless you can delve into the present moment and the present experience, you can never move on into the future. And the reason the moving on into the future is important is not because it's going to solve a problem. That when we look towards the future, we're actually looking for hope. And if a person is in pain, it's more important that they have hope than they have to solve the problem of the past. the hope will overcome that. And at, when this is part of this, when it's part of this stage, what you're really doing is you're beginning to protect yourself from future harm or from the future of doing it again. Step six is reconciliation. Action on the part of the offender is required for reconciliation. You're not always going to get reconciliation. You may find forgiveness, but not reconciliation. The action on the part of the offender is required. And for theists, this will reflect what's commonly called the justice of God. It'd be bringing two together to integrate them into a new step. In 12-step program, it's making amends. It has to be understood as a kind of repayment or payback to the self, to the offended person, and the community. There's a personal and interpersonal and cosmological elements to reconciliation. It's not just about the victim or the perpetrator. It's the victim, the perpetrator, and the community all coming together at the same time to achieve this kind of reconciliation. Now, there's some clinical issues here. There are some people that this just isn't going to work with. If you have a client who is unable to experience guilt, this isn't going to work. People who have a difficult time understanding the difference between guilt and shame, this is going to hold back the process. There are too many destructive escapes from guilt that we have to deal with. Sometimes denial is a survival skill, and that's going to depend on what kind of hurt it was and when they can move on to the future. So sometimes denial is important, usually in the earlier stages. Unfortunately, sometimes this is when some of the emotional trauma is still going on. So we need to be careful about getting somebody out of that situation too quickly, because they need to be able to live on their own. They need to be able to get the kind of support that they can get fully out of the trauma. How long does it take? One of the things that the Springers brought up in their book, they have a thing that they call cheap forgiveness. And they suggest that forgiveness is a process that takes time. And I see this frequently on TV. The news people who are very obnoxious, they'll get somebody who just lost a loved one, and I'll use a classic example. Their kid gets killed in a car crash by a drunk driver. And they shove the microphone into the face of the parents. And they say, "What do you think?" Or, "How do you feel?" And within hours of the death, they will sometimes say, "Well, I forgive them." That's what I think we mean by a cheap forgiveness. The pain is really not integrated yet. So you really can't forgive fully yet. So I think we want to be careful about that too quick of a forgiveness.
Let me intervene just for a second. This is Mark Shanker speaking again. I just sent in the chat a link to an evaluation questionnaire, and we're asking people to fill it out very quickly, and that'll help us assess the programs and future programs. I just want to let you know we have about 10 minutes to go, so I don't know if you want to leave time for questions.
I've only got three slides left.
Okay. Beautiful.
Actually, not even three. What is one of the best techniques for helping people through this process? I think it's talk therapy. I think it's allowing a lot more of a free flow. I don't think it's something that can be manualized very well. because I think that will create more cheap forgiveness. I think you have to allow people to deal with the pain, to deal with the anger, to deal with the issues of resentment and revenge, and help people through that. That is not a quick thing to do. Some of the religious and spiritual issues here, anthropology and language are important to understand. One example, prayer. Some people, especially pastoral people, will emphasize the need for prayer. And what is prayer from the ancient traditions? The original concept of prayer comes from a hunting term. And it's a hunting term that is a trap. And the idea is that when you're trapping an animal, the trap is set. I'm trying to get the picture here. The trap is set. And when the animal enters the trap, it very quickly grabs them and they are no longer free. The concept of prayer is something like a trap. They're trying to relate to their higher power, to their deity or whatever, and there's a tendency in prayer to want to trap that experience. The ancient traditions always said that once you trap the experience, you've lost it. You can never grasp the deity. You think you have it, but as soon as you think you have it, you've lost it. And that comes out of ancient Eastern as well as ancient Western spiritualities. Another concept is the process of sin. And sin also comes from a hunting term. In the original Sanskrit, the term sin was based on a bow and arrow used in hunting. And the concept was that a sin is missing the target, not getting the bullseye. And that sin, in our Western thinking, is a violation of a rule, crossing the line. In the ancient concepts, it was missing the mark. And I think if we're helping people to understand their feelings of sinfulness, one of the things that I always ask, and I learned this in Al-Anon concepts, what was going through your mind when you did that? And one time a good friend of mine in Al-Anon said, well, it was a good idea at the time. It made sense to me at the time. Now I look back and I see it was a total mess up. That's the way most people experience sin. Most people do not go out of their way to violate laws. Most people do not go out of their way to violate their relationship with God. It was a good idea at the time. So if you got people that are caught up in this concept of I'm sinful, that's a way to help forgive. How many times do you forgive? As many as it takes. In Christian scriptures, Jesus is asked that question, how many times must I forgive? And Jesus, and they say seven times, and seven is like the complete number. Jesus says, no, not seven times, but 70 times seven. There's no limit to the amount of time. And the reason is because without forgiveness, you're stuck in the past. You have to be able to get out of the past and get in the present so that you can move on into the future. Okay. We are going to make the slides available to you so that you can refer to them and, to excuse the expression, meditate on them, but also to learn some of the process to help people forgive. Okay. Any questions, comments? Well, that simplifies the process significantly. Okay, we're going to make the slides available to you. You can contact me if you want to talk about it. I see some of you I do know, but we can process some of this more one-on-one, either in emails or telephone contacts or one-on-one contacts.
Do you have a mechanism for sending the slides out? Do you want to have people email you or email
no.
me or and you'll send
yeah.
me?
I was going to email them into you folks, and
good.
Then you were going to make them available. Or if anyone wants to contact me directly, you can do that, and I can send them out to you.
If you send them to me or Nancy, we will get them posted on the website, the
okay.
addictionpsychology.org website.
Right.
Listen, if there are there any other questions? I mean, I had two thoughts. One is the thought of I forget what you said, light forgiveness, or how did you call that?
Oh, yeah. There's an issue of quick forgiveness.
Quick forgiveness, yeah.
The example is, and I think I kind of glossed over this a little bit. When I watch the news and I see a family who just lost a kid to a drunk driver, and in the midst of the car accident, when the family's there, their first response when the news people stick the microphone in their face and say, how do you feel? First of all, I want to kill the interviewer because I think that's like so horrible an experience. But when they say, well, I forgive them, they haven't had time to process the pain. And it's either that or they're in total denial about the pain, about the loss. So quick forgiveness is really not forgiveness. It's an attempt at a shortcut, and I think people need to experience and process the pain.
Yeah, and what it was reminding me of was a wonderful paper by Harry Thiebaud called Compliance versus Surrender in Therapy.
Very much.
He talked about compliance as a defense against the full acceptance of one's condition.
The whole emotional spectrum has to be experienced. You can't just take one piece of the experience and consider that the total. It has to be a process, and it has to cover all bases.
And the other question I had for you is about the concept of shame. I use a construction of shame that looks at shame as an unnecessary byproduct of guilt, that guilt is a realistic response to misdeeds. I tell people it's God's way of telling you not to do that again. But shame is when you overgeneralize that feeling to the self rather than to the behavior.
Yeah, I think we read the same books.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought I made this up, but that's okay.
Well, maybe I read your book. So you've got the shame and guilt thing going on, and when I get people coming to the sacrament of confession for us, sometimes they're confessing guilt, which is something that they've done for which they need forgiveness. But when they come in and try to confess shame, I usually try to get them involved in some kind of a conversation to help them understand that shame and guilt are two different things. And that guilt is something that as a priest, I can forgive them. But shame is not something I can forgive. Shame is something that they have to process. And I will work with them and give them some direction on how to do that. But shame and guilt are two very different things. In our American language, we kind of treat them the same, but they're very, very different.
And I often remind people that shame is the one that causes real pain. Guilt can be remediated relatively straightforward, straightforwardly with, as the ninth step puts it, making amends, forgiving yourself, forgiving the other person. But the shame is almost a cognitive distortion. It's over extrapolating from misbehavior, you know.
Yeah, I actually, when I hear confessions, and granted, I'm not a parish priest, so I don't do it that often. But when I do, I will sometimes tell people, well, I can't forgive that. Because you're trying to confess shame. You can confess guilt, but shame is something that is a process that you have to go through. The only one that can remove your shame is you. So I'll try to direct them to a counselor. Most often, if it's a sacramental thing in confession, I'll try to refer them to a counselor that I know understands the sacramental aspects of it, but I'll make them process that.